you, Sophia, again for coming on. I appreciate it. And I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while. You are a serial entrepreneur and investor and recently raised your first fund for Trust Fund, which I love the name, by the way.
Thanks.
You're building Business Class where you mentor aspiring entrepreneurs. Previously founded Nasty Gal, which you scaled to $100 million in annual revenue. Author of a couple of books, including Girl Boss, which became a Netflix series viewed by like 100 million people, I think, plus. So you've done a lot and you're still relatively young and are still, you have a lot more to do, I think. So it's great. And I'm looking forward to the conversation. But for those who aren't familiar and just sort of could use the introduction, you have an amazing story. And I don't know how much detail you want to go into, but I'm here for all of it. So it'd be great if you could sort of, introduce yourself to the audience.
Totally. I'll let it rip. Thanks for saying I'm relatively young. I think, something I learned having been this kind of like wonderkind like poster child of entrepreneurship in my 20s and raising 50 million or whatever, I'll get into it, is that you can only be impressive for your age for a while. And it's still awesome to be relatively impressive for my age. But like for everybody listening who's in their 20s, that pressure is like real and it sucks. And don't listen to it. But it's just interesting being on the other side of it. I'm like 39. It's crazy, but
Well,
it doesn't really
just to be
matter.
clear, you're super impressive for your relatively young age, not relatively
Thanks.
impressive for
Thanks.
your age.
Yeah, I don't think about it a lot, but it's kind of like what? All right. So, hello, gentlemen and lady. I'm Sophia Maruso. I am the founder and general partner at Trust Fund, which is a $5 million venture fund investing in B2B businesses. And by B2B, I mean broadly products that live at the application layer where any entrepreneur can log in and accelerate, build, start their business, fund their business. So, as an angel investor, I invested in Pipe, which is an example. Passport would be another example of that. And then I've written three checks out of the fund now to some awesome companies. One's called Plot, another one's called Gift Shop, and the other one's called Baton Market. So, I'm writing 100 to 250K checks into like, 27 to 30 companies over the next couple years. And I've got amazing LPs like Marc Andreessen and Chris Dixon and Jeff Jordan and Andrew Chen and Jeremy Liu and Paris Hilton and Rob Hayes, and like it's insane. So that's very cool. I never had a trust fund, so I guess I'm building one for myself and the kids I don't have. So I guess I'll just like keep it or something. I don't know what I'm gonna do with it. But I'm going to do a good job, and in 10 years it'll materialize. But so that's what I'm up to right now. I also have an online course for entrepreneurs called Business Class, which I launch twice a year, which is super cool. It's businessclass.co. So I'm really focused on entrepreneurs. And I'll tell you my story. And that story just kind of plays into how I can help founders and my, I guess, value prop as an investor. So I started a company called Nasty Gal when I was 22 years old. My last job was in the lobby of an art school in San Francisco at 79 New Montgomery Street called the Academy of Art College. And I was checking student IDs and having people sign in who didn't have IDs and directing them to the admissions office on the second floor. Prior to that, I worked at a record store, bookstore, photo labs, shoe store, mostly retail, all retail kind of hourly jobs. Starting an eBay store was an attempt to not work for other people, not as an entrepreneur, but to get away from what I really hated. And I thought I was like opting out of capitalism, kind of, and not whatever, working for the man or something. And put one foot in front of the other and realized, oh my gosh, when I do better, I make more money and customers are happy. And there's this amazing feedback loop where I get to learn and I get to watch my competitors. And I didn't know what reverse engineering was, but hey, I'm a good copywriter and I'm a good enough photographer and I can curate like vintage clothing that people love. It was a vintage clothing store on eBay, like not that, novel of a concept. So I did that for about a year and a half. It's called Nasty Gal Vintage. And the first year I did 75K in revenue, which was like, you know, exponentially what I'd ever made in a full year. And second year was 250K. And that was the year that I left eBay, launched my own website, and day one, it just sold out. And I was like, holy shit. So I had to go find more stuff and realize that I couldn't keep up with the demand with one-off things from thrift stores, because vintage is, they're all one of a kind. So I started going to trade shows, and that's what really allowed the business to scale, because I could take one photo like I did for vintage, but sell six dresses or 12 or, you know, eventually hundreds or, you know, I don't know, thousands. And so year three did 1.1 million, year four, 6.5, year five was 12. And on a run rate, 12 month forward facing run rate of $28 million, totally profitably, owned 100% of the business, didn't even have credit to take on debt. Some investors that I'd never really known a lot about, venture capital investors, started contacting me. And, you know, some reached out and I did my research and I was like, okay, Andreessen looks legit. Lightspeed looks legit. Index looks legit. Graycroft looks legit. And so it was in 2012 that, you know, Jeff Jordan flew to LA to the Nasty Gal offices, Jeremy Liu, and Danny Reimer from Index. And that's when I met Dana Settle from Graycroft. So those are really longstanding relationships, right? Like 11 years. And most of those people are LPs now, which is awesome. Water break. Huh. Mm. And the first money in was 50 million. It was closer to, I think, 60. It was over two rounds. I took like nine, and then I was like, let me get to know you. And then, all right, now Index, you own 20% of the company, but I own 80% because the first money in was out of a growth fund and I had already built a really sizable business. And to everyone else, it was like a freak show. They were like, what? Who is this? How does that happen? It happens because I had constraints financially, and because I didn't go to college, drop out from community college in Sacramento. So my understanding of business was buy things and sell them for more and don't spend all the money. And that there would, I wouldn't have had a business if I was doing anything other than that. So it's really not that special still in my eyes. And that like put me in Forbes magazine. That just became this like, holy shit, rags to riches. Who is this girl? You know, in 2012, 2013. And that was like, you know, Zappos C era. It was, you know, Net-a-Porter, but none of the direct to consumer businesses that have emerged since and have like, oh my God, they can run their businesses on Shopify. I'm so envious. It was a really kind of interesting, lonely time. And from the 28 million, built it to over 100 million in revenue, burned through a lot of capital, of course, became unprofitable because we raised our finger in the air and we were like, well, this company's, you know, whatever, quadrupling in revenue every year. Let's expect it to do that next year. So I had hired a COO. I had, you know, Index on my board, and I hardly knew how to read financial statements because there was just always money in the bank. It was not, I didn't run the company that way. I had saved $1 million in cash out of the back of my 1987 Volvo, and it was all in the company. And we like put our fingers in the air and we're like, what should our revenue be next year? And we were like, let's round up by 100 million. So, you know, 2012 was like, I think 2012, we were on the upswing to 28. And then we were like, great, let's hire to 100 million, or 128, excuse me. So we hired 100 people in a year. It was insane. It was like absolute insanity. I've never worked in an office that my name hasn't been on the lease of. You know, I don't want to say, it's weird to be like, I was at a disadvantage when such amazing things are happening. And it was very charming and serendipitous, this like American dream kind of rags to rich story. But the speed at which it happened was like, you know, the hockey stick was like steeper than my learning curve, and I can learn pretty quickly. And for anybody listening who's like doesn't have experience at all in anything, who's never worked for anybody or even know what leaderships look like, I recommend that you go at least have an understanding of what that looks like, because you're going to be a shitty leader if you haven't done it. Or maybe you'll just be like a special young empathetic person who gets it for some reason, but I wasn't that person. During this time in 2014, I wrote a book called Girl Boss, hashtag Girl Boss. It's been 10 years since I wrote it, 9 years since it was published, and it catapulted to the New York Times bestseller list. It spent 18 weeks there. It was a year after Lean In was published, you know, Sheryl Sandberg's big book, mm-hmm. Which was, you know, a woman with a pedigree speaking to career women in the corporate world, which I didn't relate to, and my friends didn't relate to, and I knew my customers didn't relate to. And this book kind of threw a wrench in the business book section. The Washington Post called it Lean In for Misfits. And it's an entertaining story of me trying to be like a crusty anarchist and like dumpster diving and going to anarchist book fairs and hitchhiking from Sacramento to Olympia, Washington, to being like, wow, I have freedom when I make money. Nobody's going to hassle me. I can control my life. This is crazy, which everybody else like gets out of college and knows inherently, but I do things the hard way. And that was just like a crazy, crazy, crazy phenomenon, which just put me even more in the public eye in this like really freakish way. And the book sold 500,000 copies, and the hashtag, you know, has been used over, I don't know what, 25 million times on Instagram. And it became this calling card for this like zeitgeist of women who identified with it and were like, I'm a girl boss, because they'd never seen a woman in her 20s who didn't have a big education, who didn't go, you know, who didn't start her job in a, you know, huge tech company, who didn't have rich parents, start a business and scale it to the, you know, to the scale I was able to with Nasty Gal. And it gave license to and inspired, you know, the 99% of us out there who've got like a trial account to Squarespace and we don't know if we want to pay for it once the trial period is up. You know, those are the entrepreneurs. And while, you know, the people who are on this podcast and I, you know, make the noise and get on the lists or whatever, raise the money, the majority of entrepreneurs like aren't those people. And the woman who does eyebrows is an entrepreneur. You know, the person who, the ceramicist is an entrepreneur. At this point, I think everyone is an entrepreneur. And with Trust Fund, I'm investing in products that are for entrepreneurs, but I consider them consumer products because I was the consumer of eBay. I didn't approach the platform I used with an RFP. You know, the women, the people using, you know, Squarespace and Shopify are, you know, making decisions in a lot of ways based on the brand, and they don't even know what SaaS is. So that's kind of the headset I come from, which gives me this weird kind of plebeian advantage. So the book happened, whatever, I don't know. Nasty Gal happened for 10 years from like 22 to 32. And that was a great run. Beginning of like 2015, I hired a CEO because I just hated that job. And I don't think I hired the right profile. I hired someone I absolutely love. She was a merchant and a product person, incredibly incredible, like taste level and super special person. And Nasty Gal happened for a couple years later, a couple years longer. And at the end of 2016, kind of went kerplunk because we had done over 100 million in revenue, but, you know, our investors, you know, to raise money again would have wanted us to have like a $1 billion valuation and a markup that looked great to their LPs. And, you know, for them to take a down round looks worse than, you know, keeping, you know, the investment at like whatever at cost. And fundraising just became really hard because Index didn't want to continue investing. You know, fashion e-com was like, it was like Beachmint, One Kings Lane era, like direct to consumer. It was called e-commerce. It wasn't called like direct to consumer. And so investing in like fashion e-com businesses wasn't really is on trend and had become a little less favorable. And, you know, the private equity guys who would have bought us or, you know, invested in the company and been like strategic apparel investors weren't going to be willing to pay a multiple of $350 million. And when we were doing $100 million in revenue, the comps are just different in that world. And $200 million or whatever it might have been was just not good enough for my investors. And while I owned 80% of the company and, you know, controlled the board, you know, there's stuff that happens behind the scenes that I think kind of like cock blocked my opportunity to raise money. And ultimately, Nasty Gal went through a series of Hail Marys, you know, an urban retailer of outfitter of clothing offered over $400 million for the business, which would have made me, I don't know what, over like 280 million, 300, whatever, a lot. It was on paper, I was worth so much money. And I turned it down at the, you know, the advice of my investors. And that's not to blame anybody. I was just really young and naive and took a lot of advice. And so after that, there was like a series of Hail Marys. And then we eventually did a down round. And Index was like, we own as much as we want. And the only way I can get my partnership on board, because I had taken some secondary, which like I had built a really sizable business. So like, I feel pretty good about that. There's a lot of people taking secondary last year who hadn't made a dollar in, you know, revenue at $100 million valuations. But he said, I'll double whatever of your money you put back into the business. And I was like, oh my God, like this sucks. This isn't, you know, his intent was for me to prove my conviction that I could turn this around and make it worth a multiple of $350 million or get it profitable again. I don't even know what, but I can't turn a business around. You know, I had a CEO, I was trusting the adults in the room, paying all these C-level executives whose careers were longer than my entire lifespan, and expected them to, you know, do their jobs. But I didn't really understand leadership or how to knit all of that together and deal with pissing contests and contests and, you know, cronyism and whatever. So I put $2 million back in the business, and I think, you know, Index put like $5 million or something. And then Ron Johnson came in with his buds, and that didn't really move the needle. At the end of 2016, after a series of Hail Marys and like a little bit of cock blocking that I found out about later behind the scenes that kept me, you know, from being able to raise, and like, you know, some shitty culture and some shitty headlines and all kinds of shit, we filed for Chapter 11 the day Trump was elected. And it was 10 years was an incredible run. I'm really proud of what I did. And it was also like, I was like, the only way to, I mean, I didn't know that you could bounce, but like when you raise money, the only way to like get, you can't quit and you can't be fired, I guess, unless you're like Harry Hurst or something. So it was, I can't say it wasn't like a tiny bit of relief, even though a lot of people lost their jobs, and that may be like a super tone deaf and fucked up thing to say. It's like also my life, right? Like, I don't know how eternally you can indebt yourself to other people when you're fucking miserable and like clueless about what to do next. So that happened. Started a company called Girl Boss that went on for 3 years, raised a little money from Lightspeed and Initialized, sold at the end of 2019, and then had been angel investing that whole time, and like over $1 million into like over 20 companies. My portfolio is at whatever trustfund.vc. It's like pretty good. And I've got like DPI on the books and great MOIC. and that wasn't supposed to be fund zero. It was just like, I love supporting entrepreneurs. These companies are cool, awesome. And started this thing called Business Class. It's this like amazing course for entrepreneurs, and decided to start a fund last year, and then went out in January of this year, 2023, and announced in TechCrunch that I was fundraising in public and raising $5 million. but and had all these amazing LPs on board, like the ones I mentioned earlier, and said, look, if anybody wants to invest between 2 and 20K, I'm taking applications, and I'm able to take up to 249 checks as long as my fund is under $10 million. And so within a few weeks, I had over 1,000 applications and $6.5 million of like tiny checks that people wanted to write, which is awesome. And I've taken, I don't know what, 50 or 75 of them, and I'll take some more, but the minimum is like 50K for individuals and 250K for like rich people that I meet. Don't tell them. And I have some, it's been awesome having some strategic individuals who are like a couple degrees away, or, you know, have built interesting things or are in the finance world, who can, you know, both help portfolio companies, help amplify them if they have a platform, you know, have their internal teams be beta testers for the products. There's a lot of advantage to having strategic folks on the cap table who aren't, you know, traditional investors. And since then, I have over 4 million signed for, over 5 committed, and I'm still kind of like noodling taking super qualified calls with people. But I don't want to like go job interview with like institutional investors, because that's just not who's going to get what I'm doing, at least for fund one. And I am just kind of unemployable and I don't know how to answer their questions. So here we are. I'm talking on a quite legitimate venture-ish focused podcast with Jake, and we've now reached June of 2023. I guess I left out there's a Netflix series and whatever, like Charlize Theron produced it and went for one season. It's called Girl Boss, and there's a girl in San Francisco named Sophia starting an eBay store called Nasty Gal, which was super weird. That's my story.
You almost forgot that little Netflix series that like 100 million people watched at the end.
In every language. It's the whole thing is like, it's like, wait, that happened? Like, I wake up every day and I'm like, I want coffee. And then I say this out loud and I'm like, fuck, do I even want to like remember? But it was like the best, right? It was like the best. It was so fun. And this is fun too.
Well, thank you. And for a couple of things, first of all, for coming on in the first place, but for telling your story and for making my job spectacularly easy. I just like to sit and listen to your amazing story, and I'm fortunate to ask a few questions afterwards and let people listen. But I think, you know, well, you mentioned something that I just wanted to comment on briefly, that, you know, towards the end of Nasty Gal, it was a bit of a relief, sort of saw the light at the end of the tunnel for a while, that things weren't going so well, just scaled too far and, you know, not profitable anymore. And sounds like a lot of complicated factors that sort of made that the case. Clearly you were doing, you know, much more than fine on your own, scaling all the way to like $20 million run rate, 28, maybe you said, before taking any outside capital at all, just owning the whole business, totally profitable, scaling at whatever speed felt right and natural to you. And, you know, feeling like a little bit bad when you had to close the doors, that like, you know, a lot of people lost their jobs, but not like super bad, really, because, you know, it's like your life and you've got to,
I felt super bad, but I was also like, you know,
you gotta do what you gotta do. And the other thing that I just wanted to like sort of contrast against that though, is like one of the things before we even got on that was just like crazy to me, you know, and doing prep and diligence and everything, is like imagining the number of women, I'm sure there's, you know, some men as well, but obviously, you know, largely female audience of sort of those like want to be entrepreneurs, not want to be in like a negative way, but people, you know, who are aspiring to do something where they're working more independently rather than, you know, quote unquote for the man. And like just not having any examples. I mean, even, you know, men who like, yeah, there's like tons of successful founders and entrepreneurs, but the vast majority of people are not those people. Like the vast majority of people are working for the man. And so you look around you and the examples are far and few between of the entrepreneur who decided to go against the grain versus the person who's taking a salary. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but like, just is what it is. And on, you know, for women, it's just even more extreme. And you're able to set that example and then, you know, be very transparent all along the way. And like, yeah, it sort of like blew up at the end, but like, it was a crazy ride and like an incredibly successful ride. And then writing Girl Boss afterwards, like, I can't imagine, like, degrees of magnitude, you know, orders of magnitude rather, more people must have been inspired to like start businesses and like just take the leap in life versus, you know, I don't know what, a couple hundred people, not to like marginalize it or anything, but what like a couple hundred people probably lost their job. And like, I can't imagine how many tens, hundreds of thousands of people have sort of benefited from all this that you've done. So I wouldn't feel bad about it at all. But sort of rewinding back a little bit earlier, I'm curious, like, you sort of go through pretty quickly the early days of Nasty Gal, like 250K or 75K, I think, in the first year, 250 in the second, $1 million in revenue in the third year. Like, that's super non-trivial. Like, that, especially, you know, back then there was no Shopify.
No.
D2C businesses like weren't a thing. There was just like basically no anything. You're just like writing the playbook yourself.
Like rubbing two sticks together, like hard coding an add to cart button onto a product detail page. And like, you know, there's not even fucking Google Docs or Slack or, I mean, I think we use like Gmail chat maybe for sure. But like to build a, you know, a shopping app, I had to have a team of engineers and product designers because like, you know, again, that it was, there was no front end that made it easy to do e-com. It was wild.
And like, so before you had to hire, you know, 100 people in a year or some ridiculous pace, you were doing a lot of things right. And you said like, you know, it was, you know, buying product and selling it for more than you bought it for and not spending recklessly. It was like a pretty simple formula, but obviously like it's not that simple. I think people tend to, I mean, it can be that simple in your mind and that can work, but executing on it well, there's a reason, you know, everyone's not out here, you know, creating $28 million, eventually $100 million run rate businesses. It's like extremely hard and you have to get a lot of things right. What do you think was sort of, if you had to like speculate on your formula, my outside view is that you're exceptional at like branding, design, and sort of this taste and style that you have, which as far as I can tell, might sort of extend from building a great website to selecting great products or, you know, creating great products to naming great companies and having the branding all sort of on point. But it might even have something to do with like how you hired people, like your sort of taste in people. I don't really even know, but something along those lines. Like, what do you think was part of that magical formula? And just like take us through some of like the big wins and positives that you can recall, if you can, from sort of those first 2 or 3 years, which was just going from, you know, like you said, all sorts of odd jobs to 75K revenue in a year, 250K the next, a million the next, 6.5 the next, like crazy, crazy success.
Yeah. I mean, it was, thank you. It was step by step, right? Like the first person, I mean, in terms of being good at the brand, I looked at what was on eBay and there was a lot of girls selling vintage clothing and that shit's like sitting around everywhere. And if you, I learned the power of perceived value by buying things for $8 and describing them accurately, putting them on a cute girl who's aspirational, but not so aspirational that she's unrelatable, and looks maybe kind of like an editorial in Nylon magazine. So culturally contextual, she's going somewhere. She's not just standing there like glum. She's got a handbag, you know, she's got sunglasses, there's movement in the photo. And this was a time when like, you know, Nordstrom considered their online store like one of their doors, like it was like one of their department stores, like e-com wasn't even like in, you know, an important channel for them. And I brought like a sense of life into e-com photography and copy, and like levity that entertained me and connected with, you know, our customer who saw herself in that girl or saw her future self and an aspirational version of herself, you know, a girl that could be her friend. She's not intimidating, but she's got like a motorcycle jacket on and she's going somewhere. I want to go there. And I don't know, I've never worn a leather motorcycle jacket, but she makes it look cool. Maybe I could wear it. Oh shit, I bought it. Oh shit, I'm wearing it. And I feel so much more confident. Like I put a red lip on and I am no longer a wallflower. Nasty Gal bred this level of confidence that had nothing to do with the clothing. The clothing was just a vehicle for it. And there was just this like insane emotional alchemy of women who identified with the girl they wanted to be pretty soon, but weren't quite yet. And that's like a super magical thing. And it's what Girl Boss, the book, did. It's what I'm investing in with Trust Fund is products that, you know, for the most part, the average person would be like, oh, I want to build my business. I read the copy on the site. If I use this product, like I can accelerate or start what this is and manage people better or fundraise or whatever it may be, project manage. And to me, that like consumer application or the consumer headset and that level of aspiration is the throughput and everything that I've done. And I don't know where that came from. I think it's just like, you know, this is what I would have wanted. And with the products I'm investing in, like I stared, like you said, like I stared into the void, you know, in this wild west of e-com with like no saw, like nothing, you know? And so I felt every pain point that a founder either at, you know, the SMB bootstrappy level or, you know, a venture back founder who's scaling experiences. And I've watched all these products emerge that help them and enviously. And because of that, have this kind of unique perspective on what they need, both the, you know, founder who has a great background, went to a great school, they're going to encounter the same stuff. But I think what's especially powerful is this like founder out there who's like, am I a business person or am I just, let's give this a shot, and is figuring it out as they go. And they're not a traditional business person because they're freelancers or creators or solopreneurs or service providers. And I understand what needs to be demystified for the average person. And I think that demystification was something that I did with Style for Nasty Gal. And, you know, with this, I guess, aspirational yet relatable picture of this like goofy drop loser who like figured it out and started this eBay store and got really far. I don't know. Like, I like laughing at like words and stuff. So naming stuff has always just been super fun and often like rooted in culture. So, you know, I never hired an agency to name a business. I was so envious and kind of angry when, I guess resentful is like maybe that word, when like Red Antler emerged and these like, because when I was in the Bay Area, you couldn't hire a graphic designer who didn't just do like straight up silver and white like product design. There was like very little like brand design. And I was so proud of like what I'd done because it emerged from like my cultural references and things that mattered to me and my understanding of culture. And now someone, you know, who's like, let's sell a mattress, could just like buy it, whatever. And so Nasty Gal was named after an album by a woman named Betty Davis, who was this amazing funk singer, was married to Miles Davis, was allegedly too wild for him. So that didn't last long. She had a song and an album called Nasty Gal. And then Girl Boss, there's this like relatively obscure genre of 70s film called Pinky Violence. And Tarantino has like borrowed a lot from it. And it's very specifically women, it's like female revenge films and like women like street fighting and like women in jail, like breaking out of jail. And it's really fun. And it's like really cool, like Japanese women with like insane style. And there's one called Girl Boss Gorilla, like GUE, Gorilla. And I just like loved the name. So I was like, cool, name my book Girl Boss. There was never another name for Girl Boss. And Business Class is a double entendre because it's like, yeah, it's descriptive. But if you go on our website, you see me dressed like a Pan Am flight attendant, and everything, like the modules are called flights and the like lessons are called legs, and our community is called the lounge, and it runs for 10 weeks, but there are three layovers, which are like catch up weeks. It's just like endless fun. I just love it. It just like entertains me. If you're going to do this stuff, you might as well entertain yourself.
Yeah. It's this like combination of the, like you just described a business class, the intricacy, I guess, of like you take this top level name and then build the whole thing around it. Like there's no inherent reason why a class for entrepreneurs needs to be associated with like flying or anything, but you came up with the name and you liked it and it's ironic and it works. And then it just so happens that like legs and flights and layovers, you make them all work in a way that's like so seamless. And then like people, you know, go to the website and like trust, I know it's trustfund.vc, business class, is it, what's the domain for that one?
Businessclass.co.
Businessclass.co, like any of these, Sophia's personal website, like they're just like so clean and pleasant. And that's just like the website design. But when you were talking about the photography on, you know, some of the early items you were selling, like you can hear it right away, like all these different elements that you're describing, all the thought that went into it, like the details. I sometimes am like sort of have conflicting thoughts on this, because just like the sort of the level of detail that's worthwhile going into, you have like sort of the Steve Jobs quote of like, you know, make sure the back of the dresser looks good, even though no one's ever going to see it. So then he makes like the inside of the computer, the desktop computer, like everyone from Apple signs in. It's like very nice because it doesn't matter if no one's ever going to see it. You just sort of do everything, every little detail with like excellence. And then that sort of leads to like an excellent overall thing. And that's like sort of what I'm reminded by the way you're describing these photographs. But then on the other side of things, there's like, well, you know, sometimes perfection is like the enemy of done. And like, you just sort of need to get it out. And there's like this everlasting balance between these two things that I think about, but definitely
it's really hard. And it's, sorry, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, definitely when you do, like, it's hard not to respect the people who do go down into the dirty details and just get every single little thing as great as they can. And then eventually, obviously, you have to pull the trigger and ship it. Those are always sort of admirable perspectives to hear.
Yeah. And I still do it. Like every word on the Business Class website, I wrote like every word of copy. You asked about scaling it and hiring people. And, you know, when you're playing in culture, it can be super dangerous to hire quote unquote cool people, because they're working with like accountants and they're working with digital marketing people. And those people aren't, at least don't think they're as creative, or don't have the same kind of creative roles. And what happened at Nasty Gals became this kind of like have and have nots of like what's cool. And people threw it around as a weapon. Like Sophia wouldn't have liked that. Like things like that would happen when I wasn't in the room, which I never like, you know, co-signed on, which made other people feel really shitty. And it was way too late that we put together a brand book that was like, here it is. There's this objective thing that we can now all point at. And that's the brand. It's not me. It's not you. Like, we can all hold each other accountable because it's that. And when you don't have that and it's really nebulous and it can be, you know, and it's, yeah, when it's subjective, it can be like a really dangerous thing.
Yeah, I think it's hard to like, I mean, I don't know from experience of building like a large culture or anything, but just as an observer, it seems extremely hard to like, you know, every culture kind of is toxic, I think, to some degree. Maybe that's like a really hot take, but like, you know, you look at the largest levels, like our country, it's like pretty toxic situation going on. You look at like small companies, there's like founder disagreements that like kill many of these early stage startups. Just like really seems like a very difficult problem. And I think amazing cultures tend to be like fleeting by nature. And maybe you had that in the early days of Nasty Gal. And that alone is like quite an achievement, I think. But I know we're kind of coming up on time, and you know, it's been great going on what we've gone on so far, but we haven't talked about your fund at all. And I want to make sure if there's some you know, wealthy individuals listening in that they're well aware of what you're doing there. So you sort of alluded to it earlier, some great LPs raising several million dollars and have that community raise as a part of it, which is really cool. You've got, from what I understand, like some pretty incredible deal flow. I heard you on like a podcast in April. So you had like 400 cold pitches already, and that was like 3 or 4 months in. So with all this deal flow, like, you know, you've got, like you said, plenty of interest in investing in the fund, and you're just kind of being conservative from the beginning to not raise more than you feel comfortable deploying and sort of being able to learn and then scaling with the next one sort of as you feel comfortable. The deal flow seems to totally be there. So it kind of comes down to judgment. How are you sort of figuring out where you want to allocate this money?
I think it's like, is this, you know, for me to return a $5 million fund and I invest, I don't know what, I don't know, 100K, or if I own 1% of a company and it becomes a $500 million business, I've returned the fund. So I'm kind of optimizing for like 1 to 2% ownership. I'm not the first check-in. And I'm looking for founders who can build things that are, you know, that can be billion-dollar businesses. And I also, and a lot of people don't think of this, and you're not supposed to think of it, but it's like, who's gonna buy this thing? Like, I look at stuff and I'm like, who would this be strategic for? And you never really know. I feel like I see all kinds of like wacky acquisitions, and it's like, really, those people bought that, or that company bought that? But I still think about it. You know, a $5 million fund, people would assume I'm investing like entirely at pre-seed, like, you know, $1 million rounds at like 8 million post or 10 or something. And I just, you know enough or have seen enough to know that like anybody can have an idea. If and so I'm investing like almost exclusively at seed, which means I'll own less, but I also feel more confident in what I'm investing in. I also often have you know, top tier funds alongside me at seed, which you don't have as much at pre-seed. That, like, to a certain extent, like, of course I'm not like a follower, but you know, Accrue Capital is going to see like all the fintech deals, and they're going to invest in the best ones, and they're going to be like, oh, I've seen 10 of these. Like, I don't see all of them. It's there's one of me, you know. I don't have like a fintech partner and a, you know, whatever, at a marketplace expert. Like, I'm investing in all of this stuff, and so, you know, there's a little bit of me that relies on that cosign. I, you know, look for founders who have operated in the area they're investing or have felt the pain points of the end user. I also like to feel the pain point of the end user and have that level of empathy, so I can empathize with the founder I'm investing in, and then also because I've done it, but also and understand like the use case of the product, and then ultimately what I consider their consumer. And not, yes, it's a business, but you know, a lot of freelancers aren't thinking about, you know, like I said earlier, if I love second time entrepreneurs, like who doesn't? If I can invest in people who have already either pulled it off or blown it. Pulled it off is ideal, but if they're impressive and they learned a lot from their first business, and I talked to them and it sounds like they can apply that to their second business, awesome. And companies that like ultimately, yeah, I can make an impact on in like internally, personally, because of my experience and network and ability to like make introductions and all that stuff, but also amplify. So it's not really relevant for me to amplify, I don't know what, some dev tool to the million people who follow me across social, which is like an awesome asset to have as an investor. But were I to invest in Notion, I would like my audience would be like Fuck yeah. So to give you an idea of like this GP market fit that I've found, I've been approached by, you know, SurveyMonkey and Notion and SoFi, who I worked with, which is, you know, B2C, but still fintech, in the last 6 months, who are like, hey, can we pay you to like evangelize our products on your social channel? So they got like marketing teams doing research. And it's not fashion companies coming to me. And I don't think the people who follow me care as much about fashion. Like, you know, they want to, you know, they're like 30, 35, whatever. They want to build shit and buy a house, right? So that gave me a lot of confidence because I thought that was what the people who followed me like and what I have some expertise in. But, you know, marketing teams agreeing is awesome. And then, what was I going to say? I don't know.
Well, that's a good enough pitch for a lot of people, I think. And awesome. I think it's really smart, and it's like sort of humble. I don't know. I like the strategy because basically what you're saying is like, look, I'm not looking to like build a small team. You obviously have been there, done that, not looking to do that again. You're trying to advise companies that are sort of best suited or, you know, will be most helped by your very unique sort of set of skills and advice. And, you know, so you're not trying to like reinvent the wheel on like some algorithm for identifying companies as early as possible. And, you know, all that, you're sort of leaning on and leveraging some of the best funds in the world who are already doing that. And you have tremendous access to be able to get allocations in those deals. So you could sort of take your pick of the litter. And then I don't think, you know, if I'm sort of understanding right, like what you care about, what's fun for you is not like diligencing deals, it's helping founders and with the problems that you've been through firsthand and want to help other people avoid or mitigate to the best that they can. So sounds really exciting. And I guess in closing, you know, because we're over on time, but I really appreciate you coming on. It's been awesome talk with you. And before this even, just you know, listening to other podcasts that you've been on and reading some of the stuff you've written, it's an awesome story, and I appreciate you coming on and sharing it. But where can people go to, you know, if they are interested in maybe, you know, looking at trust fund to invest in their company or to invest in trust fund as an LP? Where do you want to send people?
It would be trustfund.vc. We've got a link for pitches. We got a link for people to apply as like LPs. And then, you know, you can go, I'm sure you, a lot of people listening have got like degrees of connection in my network. Twitter works, you know, it's like you contacted me on Twitter. I've made such awesome relationships on Twitter over the last year. And then like Instagram, I'm at Sophia Amoruso, whatever, Twitter, same, whatever. And then I think, you know, one thing that you kind of referred to was like, I just wrote my first LP update. It's Q2 23, so it may not be relevant later, but I also made that public. And so you can link that in the show notes, and it's like really fun and visual, and like I loved writing it. So that might be an interesting place for people to poke around.
Yeah, I read that, and I will link that. And I appreciate you linking this podcast as an upcoming podcast that you were going to go on. So thank you for doing that. And thank you for coming on. It's been awesome talking with you, and hope to keep in touch.
You too.